You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Comedy of Errors, Dave Chappelle's Big Lie. The comedian's greatest offense is a sin of omission, and whom he forgets says all we need to know, by Jamila Lemieux. With opening illustration by Quentin McMillan, which shows numerous versions of Dave Chappelle's face in different colors on a background of red. I was in a bad state for about a week after the closer, pissed, disappointed, confused, watching how many black folks, including some I know and love deeply, puffed their chest out alongside comedian Dave Chappelle and echoed his conviction that the alphabet people were being given something, kindness, civil rights, that the blacks were not receiving with the same ease. It's one thing to, say, challenge immigration policies that make it so that white folks can safely and legally seek asylum here, while people from black nations are deported, and worse. But you cannot pit the blacks against the alphabet people, nor can you separate the blacks from women, or bitches, as Chappelle calls us. Many of us are both or more, and when you try to separate us, sort us, you feed the black-ass lie. Black Americans are not solidly unified around many things aside from the desire to be free, and we don't all agree on what freedom looks like. We don't have a singular political agenda, nor a governing document that lines up our shared values. However, I will argue, as I have for the last 20 years and will until my last breath, that aside from craving liberation, black folks are only single-minded in believing strongly that black men are disenfranchised by the proverbial system, and that our people have an obligation to care for them. Black conservatives, black feminists, and nearly everyone in between speak seriously of the plight of the black man. But the black man is too often coded language for the cishet black man. The degree to which any other groups of black people are suffering, that is up for debate. Black America's version of the big lie, the black ass lie, is that black men have it worse than any other group of black people. In her best-selling Eloquent Rage, scholar and crunk feminist collective co-founder Brittany Cooper writes, black men grow up believing and moving through the world, politically, as though they have it the toughest, as though their pain matters most, as though black women cannot possibly be feeling anything similar to the dehumanization and disrespect they have felt. There is little to no consideration of what those of us who are harmed by misogyny, and maybe hurt even worse, might endure. Black women have not been particularly outspoken about Chappelle's treatment of us in his work. Before daring to wade into this mess of a media cycle, I had been too badly burned by reactions to my criticism of actual sex offenders like Bill Cosby and R. Kelly to risk what would come of triggering Chappelle's sensitive audience. I suspect part of that has to do with the ways we're socialized to make space for our men to speak, particularly through art. In the 1990s, civil rights activist and elder C. Dolores Tucker was made the scourge of young black people everywhere for daring to stand up to hip-hop, setting the tone for what black women who dared to critique the culture could expect. While the advent of social media has given us outspoken black bitches more of a platform than we could have ever hoped for in the past, it's also made it easier than ever to harass and demean us. We don't even have to ask black women to sacrifice for our survival, the author Michael Denzel Smith wrote, "An Invisible Man Got the Whole World Watching." They do so without formal request. In turn, we dismiss the concerns of black womanhood as trivial or divisive, failing to see black women's pain as real or in need of our attention. A famous Chappelle's Show sketch mocks the infamous tape of R. Kelly urinating on an underage black girl that first circulated in black barbershops, over bootleg tables, and on porn sites in 2002. In a video for a song called "I Wanna Pee on You," Chappelle instead cast adult women. Instead of satirizing Kelly as an alleged predator, we already knew he'd married Aaliyah when she was 15. He's merely mocked for an unhygienic kink. R. Kelly was acquitted of child pornography charges in 2008, but this September, he was convicted of sexual exploitation of a child and sex trafficking, among other crimes, and whose victims include Aaliyah, and faces more child pornography charges related to the 2008 case. He has maintained his innocence. "It is hard for me, as a woman in her 30s, to think about the reactions I saw adult black men and women have to the Kelly tape back then and for many years after. To me, it seems that the bit and the positive reception to it spoke volumes about the inability of Chappelle and most people to have empathy for black girls and women. We wouldn't laugh side by side with white folks about any of the instances of black men or boys being harmed by state violence. How could black women be asked to laugh at rape jokes alongside essentially the same folks who'd be allowed to rape us with impunity? It's the black-ass lie." Scholar and sister friend Brittany Brathwaite dropped a gem in a recent conversation. "There is this communal grief over the death of black women, of black men, but not over the rape of black women. People get so upset that they have to miss work because they read about a man they never met getting killed in a city they've never been to. But when it comes to crimes against black women's bodies," she says, "the cognitive dissonance is astounding." The airing of a two-part, 10-hour docuseries dedicated to decades of his sexual violence should have had the nation in a chokehold a la Roots. If black women and girls cannot summon the enthusiastic support of our own folks, you can easily guess what sort of solidarity we enjoy from white folks and non-black people of color, many of whom gladly benefit from the fact that at least they aren't black and female, but also from the amount of labor black women perform on behalf of diversity causes. In 8:46, the acclaimed short special that Chappelle recorded and released during the season of protest inspired by the death of Breonna Taylor, he manages to talk about police violence for nearly half an hour without naming a single black woman who'd fallen victim. The erasure of black bitches murdered by the state reminded me of the polarizing efforts to center us in the anti-police violence movement sparked by the death of Missouri teen Michael Mike Brown in 2014. Though many of the most visible young organizers were black women and or LGBTQ+ people, There were others who felt that acknowledging how these populations fare at the hands of the police distracted from the bigger picture. I took many trips to Ferguson to cover the protest, and I was always struck by the presence of black trans women. I knew, and I knew they knew, that the community would never have shown up for them in the same numbers. Indeed, some of the people marching for Mike Brown would have gladly participated in violence against those bitches. And until the deaths of Taylor and Sandra Bland, it would have been easy for many to believe that black women aren't victims of police violence at all. The black-ass lie finds us able to focus only on one target. Despite Chappelle's shortcomings with regard to understanding and reflecting the experiences of black women and LGBTQ plus people, those of all races consider him to be an important black voice. Watching Chappelle's show is essentially as close to reading critical race theory as the average American white boy will likely ever get. People go to him for profound racial insights. Sometimes he delivers. Other times, he is weighed down by how little he seems to think of black people who aren't what he'd consider men. If we can't challenge him to think a bit more deeply about certain urgent issues, that has profound ramifications. In The Gorgeous, If He Hollers, Let Him Go, a National Magazine Award finalist essay, the writer Rachel Kadzi Ganza is among the chorus, "Dave Chappelle is without a doubt his generation's smartest comic." Citing his upbringing around Jewish kids, black kids, and Vietnamese immigrants, she credits the comic with using these experiences to become America's consul and translator for all things racial. More than any comic of his generation, he lanced the boil of how race works and also prodded at how nuanced race had become. It might be incredible that someone could compel such praise as a racial translator, a spokesperson for his people, while having such a shitty lens on gender and sexuality. Alas, what more can you expect when the black man's needs are black needs? The black man's plight is the black plight, but when it comes to the black bitches, we're on our own. We have ourselves, and sometimes some of the other bitches to call upon. That's due in part to the black-ass lie. I'd wager that the majority of Chappelle's black critics, present bitch included, do not seek to see the gifted comic silenced. We want to be able to laugh, too. If anyone deserves to, we do, because the joke has been on us for far too long. Thank you. Tech Talk into the metaverse. Like it or not, the next stage of the Internet revolution is coming, by Nick Bilton. Science fiction has long looked toward augmented reality, and now it's almost here. Just how dystopian will it be? Opening illustration by Quentin McMillan, showing a distorted human being wearing virtual reality goggles. A couple of years ago, I was sitting with Bob Iger in his office at Disney headquarters in Burbank when he asked me if I wanted to see something cool. Sure, I said, uncertain what magic trick he was about to pull out of his hat. He walked over to his giant wooden desk covered with Star Wars, Marvel, and Disney paraphernalia and grabbed his iPad. He then proceeded to show me video clips from movies Disney was working on at the time, all footage of people and animals that I was sure were filmed with actors, but that Iger informed me were 100% CGI. My mind literally couldn't decipher between reality and a computer-generated version of it. As I sat speechless, Iger looked at me with his trademark all-American smile and said, "The crazy part about all of this is that every time we render a new scene, the technology used to make it is already outdated. It's already obsolete." Now, the whole world is getting closer to having that same experience. For better, and probably for worse, the metaverse is about to change everything. The term metaverse was first coined in Snow Crash, a science fiction novel published in 1992, in which author Neal Stephenson imagines a virtual world where humans, as avatars, interact with each other and other artificially intelligent versions of people in an online virtual world that has been built to resemble the real world. As technology has grown and morphed, the ideas around the metaverse have too, and we've seen iterations of it brought to dramatic life in Ernest Cline's novel Ready Player One, where people interact and also die in the virtual oasis. Or in The Matrix, where they die too. Don't worry, you're not going to die in our metaverse, at least not yet. Over the next 5 years or so, in this next chapter of our company, I think we will effectively transition from people seeing us as primarily being a social media company to being a metaverse company, Mark Zuckerberg told The Verge in an interview earlier this year, before the company was beset by its most recent slew of scandals. You can think about the metaverse as an embodied internet, where instead of just viewing content, you are in it. Now, Zuckerberg has changed the name of the company to Meta. In a world where the metaverse exists, rather than hosting a weekly work meeting on Zoom, you could imagine meeting in a physical representation of your office, where each person looks like a digital version of themselves, seated at a digital coffee table, drinking digital artisanal coffee, and snacking on digital donuts. If that sounds boring, you could meet somewhere else, perhaps in the past, like in 1776 New York City, or in the future, on a spaceship, or on another planet, if it made sense for the meeting, of course. You could choose not to be yourself, but rather some form of avatar you picked up at the local online NFT swap meet or at a virtual Balenciaga store. You could dress like a bunny to go to the meeting. A dragon. A dead dragon. And that's just one measly little meeting. You could take a British history class taught by a digital representation of King George III. Or learn about the theory of relativity from Albert Einstein himself. You could attend a TED Talk or give one. You could hook up your exercise bike to race against Maurice Garin in the Tour de France, or your running machine to race against Usain Bolt at the Olympics and lose. You could go to the zoo. You could be an animal at the zoo, visit the Louvre, the International Space Station. You could go for a walk on Mars, float in space. You could go to a theme park and ride the world's biggest roller coaster and maybe even throw up in real life. You could go shopping, trying on outfits that are actually mailed to your house once you pay for them, probably in Bitcoin or Ethereum. There are also lots of potential dark sides of the metaverse. Don't be surprised to see Nazi rallies and people who choose racist and dangerous avatars or hackers stealing from people or performing metaversal terrorism, whatever that becomes. For all the talk about NFTs, the metaverse is where they start to actually make sense. Kind of. Perhaps you own a Beeple NFT that's worth $70 million. In the real world, you can only show it to someone on your computer or brag about it on social media. But in the metaverse, you could hang it on the wall of your digital house so your digital guest can enjoy it. Or you could put it in a digital art museum and charge people a small fee, paid for in crypto, to come and see the piece like it's the Mona Lisa. A lot of this might sound like something you may have heard about before, or even seen and engaged with in a crude technological form. Back in 2003, a version of the metaverse called Second Life launched as a standalone world that you could hang out in, not too distinct from the stuff we're talking about now. But Second Life was a closed system, and what's more, the technology just wasn't ready. To understand how the metaverse might become real, you have to go back and see how technology has evolved over the last four decades to bring us the digital world we live in today. At first, there was simply the internet, a bunch of tubes and wires connected together that allowed people to send email and chat on message boards. By 1989, Tim Berners-Lee had created the World Wide Web, which allowed people to connect to the internet through a browser, which in turn went to millions of websites, spawning the advent of things like Yahoo and Google. A decade later came Web 2.0, which brought user-generated content in the forms of Blogger, Flickr, and Pandora, and this eventually morphed into social media. All of these were new layers placed atop the original foundation of the internet. Today, we largely interact in an app-based layer where we engage with content and with one another through apps we download to our smartphones, Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, Slack, and so on. The next layer is the metaverse. The ways in which you enter the metaverse will likely be what makes or breaks it. Today, we access the internet with such ease via apps. You just pick up your phone, press a button, and you're talking to people on Facebook, reading a book on the Kindle app, or playing Fortnite. The metaverse will have to work the same way. Click, and you're on or in. But there will be countless ways in which you can access it. You can imagine entering some aspects of it on your smartphone or computer, or perhaps through a game console or your television, which would give you a different kind of immersive experience. But where the true metaverse experiences will likely flourish is through virtual reality and augmented reality. Over the past few years, several companies, including Facebook, Apple, Google, and Ray-Ban, have been working on creating digital glasses, headsets, and contact lenses that could end up adding a layer of the metaverse to real life. In this scenario, the metaverse wouldn't just be a place you go in the digital world, but a place layered on top of the real world, augmented reality. You could imagine wearing your avatar out in the real world, where other people who are wearing headsets see an augmented version of their reality, including you dressed up as your avatar, which could also change based on who is looking at you. Maybe you appear as a three-headed puppy to your kids, but a professional in a suit to your coworkers. You could sit in a coffee shop in New York while a friend sits in a coffee shop in Paris and have a real coffee together, even though you're not in the same place. In order for the metaverse to become truly successful, it will need to feel so real that it becomes unclear if you're in reality or in the metaverse. The reason that such a scenario has been left to the annals of science fiction until now is because the technology hasn't caught up. Computer chips, processors, screen rendering capabilities, and 3D software engines are simply not fast enough. But that is all changing quickly. Then there's the question of what the science fiction has predicted. In Snow Crash and Ready Player One, the metaverse is not a totally happy place. In fact, it's often portrayed as a dystopia, run by one megalomaniac who is hell-bent on ruling over everyone in society, and doing so through the technology he runs. Not too dissimilar to a certain someone who just changed his company's name to Meta. Now, here's the issue's cover story. Everything's coming up, Priyanka. At home with the internationally famous actor, singer, author, and entrepreneur, as she tries to be all things to everyone and succeeds, by Rebecca Ford. Styled by Leith Clark. Photographs by Emma Summerton. Opening photos, Priyanka Chopra Jonas, photographed by Vanity Fair on November 10, 2021, in London. Upstairs is crazy. This is definitely not normal. There's a flurry of activity at the Chopra Jonas place in Encino. Dozens of people are rushing around, moving cars in and out of the garage, carrying boxes and unwrapping dishes and glassware. Priyanka Chopra Jonas sits down across a table from me in the quiet game room downstairs and laughs. I swear it's not always like this. Priyanka, which she prefers that I call her here, is readying for a party, gathering her family, in-laws, and Hollywood friends for the first major event at her home in the San Fernando Valley. The house itself is a major event, by the way, a 20,000-square-foot home with a 2-lane bowling alley, an indoor basketball court, a movie theater, and an infinity swimming pool that gives way to a gorgeous view of the distant hills. The party will be a Diwali celebration as well as a housewarming. Priyanka and her husband of 3 years, Nick Jonas, bought the place for a reported $20 million at the end of 2019, just before the pandemic forced everyone inside. They spent their first 6 months together doing what some of us did in those early, unsteady days, eating pizza every night, watching movies at 4 in the morning, sleeping in. Since then, though, they've had to be largely apart, working in different parts of the world. "I want to be at home," Priyanka tells me. "I've been away for almost a year now." At the moment, her husband is occupied upstairs. "We both have a shoot today. So that's the thing about this house. Both him and I have had 20-year careers, and I think we finally built a home that accommodates our individual lives." Hosting tomorrow night's party will allow Priyanka to do something she does exceedingly well: make people feel welcome. Many of the friends and collaborators I talk to about her note her ability to put anyone at ease, and I feel it almost immediately. Priyanka's wearing a casual plaid navy shirt dress and sandals, her long hair still damp from the shower. In person, she is warm and charming, with a ready laugh and engaging eyes. She moves from deep conversation to light jokes with ease. She can come across as so regal and refined, which she certainly is, but she's also got this carefree joy about her, and she just exudes it, says her husband. She's an incredible host in that way. I'm more of a reserved person at first, and I open up with friends and people as I get to know them better, but she can make you feel like you're in the family and a part of the inner circle right away. Jada Pinkett Smith, who starred in The Matrix Resurrections with Priyanka, puts it this way: "She's just a ball of light. She's funny and she's witty, and she just enjoys life. It's magnetic." Behind that light and magnetism, of course, is a driven woman who has transcended what's previously been possible for an Indian actor in Hollywood. After becoming one of the biggest movie stars in India, Priyanka left home at the peak of her Bollywood career and created, step by step, a career in America that's reaching new heights. Last year, she published her memoir, Unfinished, now a New York Times bestseller, launched her hair care line, Anomaly, raised millions of dollars to aid India during the pandemic, opened an Indian restaurant in New York, and starred in the Matrix sequel. Later this year, with the rom-com Text for You and Amazon's ambitious spy series Citadel, Priyanka will finally be playing lead film roles as she had in India. It's a moment she has been building toward for 20 years. She is an outsider who broke down barriers and built a place for herself within the walls of Hollywood. Now she's on a mission to welcome others in. It's taken a lot of pavement pounding to be able to get people's attention and to be able to get an acceptance of the fact that someone like me can be the lead of a Hollywood feature, she says. There's very few of us from South Asia who get to do that. I hope that the part that I play in it will sort of push the envelope a little bit. Priyanka, who's 39, has already lived many lives. She was born in India. Her parents were military physicians, then moved to the U.S. as a teenager to live with her aunt. Routinely bullied for being Indian, Priyanka returned to India after 3 years to finish her high school education at the Army Public School in Bareilly. In 1999, her mother and brother entered her in her first pageant, and she went on to win Miss India World and ultimately Miss World 2000. Within 10 years of launching her Bollywood career, she became one of the most successful actors working in India's massive movie industry, the world's largest producer of films, with billions of tickets sold a year. Priyanka often shot multiple films simultaneously. She became insanely famous, can't walk down the street famous. It was then that her manager, Anjula Acharya, urged her to move back to the U.S. to pursue a music career with the legendary record executive Jimmy Iovine. Other Hindi film stars had tried to break into the U.S. market, but none achieved anything like the same stardom. I wasn't looking to do work in America, Priyanka tells me. I was at this amazing point in my career. I was doing critically acclaimed work and winning awards. So she called me, and I kind of laughed at the idea. In the end, she took the leap and signed a record deal with Universal Music Group. Priyanka became the first Bollywood star ever signed at CAA and released a few singles, collaborating with Pitbull and will.i.am. It was just magical, she says. So those 3-4 years just went by. I was being serenaded by this rock and roll lifestyle. It was booking the lead role of FBI trainee Alex Parrish in the ABC series Quantico in 2015 that allowed Priyanka to move from a fledgling music career back into acting. Quantico, for me, was a really big win, she says, not just because of being the first time an Indian or South Asian actor was lead of a network show, but more than that, because I was not put in the box, like the show wasn't my big fat Indian wedding. The Parrish character was written without a specific ethnicity in mind, which is something Priyanka had longed for. She didn't want to be pigeonholed for being Indian or cast as a trope. Once she'd won the role, she added some touches from her own background, included speaking Hindi on the show. After that, I just started looking for parts like that, where my ethnicity is something that is an asset, but I'm not defined by it. Priyanka was the first South Asian actor to win a People's Choice Award for the role. She won two. And when Quantico wrapped, after 3 seasons in 2018, she had already begun appearing in a smattering of films, playing a vampy villain in Baywatch, a yoga instructor in the comedy Isn't It Romantic, and a fiercely determined mother in the family drama The Sky is Pink. The last of these was produced by Purple Pebble Pictures, which Priyanka co-founded with her mother, Madhu Chopra. The company has a TV deal with Amazon, and Priyanka says she's focused on telling predominantly South Asian stories and ones centered on women. I'm looking at doing very hyper-specific storytelling. As for the responsibility that comes with representing South Asians in her work, she adds, I may make my mistakes, because this is not a mantle I was looking for. But I think collectively, each one of us can push Hollywood and push the powers that be, and be demanding, and not just polite about it. I've been polite for a very long time. Now it's time to say, I'm sorry, that doesn't work, and to fight for your characters. As a producer, I'm so grateful that I get the opportunity to do that, to be able to make stories and look for stories that normalize different cultures of the world. Last year, Priyanka executive produced and starred in The White Tiger, an adaptation of an Aravind Adiga novel exploring India's caste systems through the experience of one wealthy family's driver. When she sets her mind to accomplish something, which could be producing a film, it could be her business ventures, she's relentless, says the film's writer-director Raman Barani, whose screenplay was nominated for an Oscar. And when it comes to the performance, she's the same. Lots of questions, and all good questions, great instincts. When I ask Priyanka how the roles she's looking for have changed, she pauses. I'm scared to say this, she says. I encourage her to go on. When I first came here, to get the attention, I had to sort of shed my ethnicity a lot more so that it was not alien, she says. I had to play parts which were more American to get a seat at the table. Now that I've got a seat at the table, I've reverted back to playing parts that embrace my ethnicity. Midway through my conversation with Priyanka, I start to see flashes out of the corner of my eye. Nick's photo shoot is underway just up the stairs. The game room is partly a shrine to music. The walls are hung with big vintage rock photos, the Rolling Stones on stage, the Beatles arriving at an airport to a crush of reporters, Kurt Cobain in a reflective moment. At the far end of the room, there's an upright piano and an acoustic guitar lying on a couch, along with an old arcade-style Pac-Man machine. There's an absurd narrative about Priyanka and her husband that sometimes slithers into view, implying that she married Jonas, who's 10 years younger, to get more famous. In 2018, shortly after the couple's glam multi-day wedding in a palace in Jodhpur, India, The Cut actually ran a piece accusing Priyanka of being a scam artist who had somehow ensnared the singer. The piece received the trashing it deserved for being sexist and xenophobic, and was eventually taken down with an apology from the outlet. For the record, Priyanka is much more successfully globally, with twice as many Instagram followers as Jonas, for starters. 71.5 million to his 31.8 million. She starred in more than 50 films, won India's version of the Oscar for the 2008 drama Fashion, and been on the cover of Vogue India 11 times. Priyanka doesn't trot these stats out herself, obviously. She's in love with a guy, not competing with him. But it's clear that the ignorance about who she is and what she's accomplished rankles every so often. In March 2021, when the couple was about to host the Oscar nominations announcement, an Australian journalist tweeted, "No disrespect to these two, but I'm not sure their contribution to the movies qualifies them to be announcing Oscar nominees." "Enough already," Priyanka responded. "Would love your thoughts on what qualifies someone. Here are my 60-plus film credentials for your adept consideration." She included a link to her IMDb page. "I usually don't get mad, but that just pissed me off," she tells me now. Priyanka is the first to acknowledge how much the U.S. has inspired and supported her, but there are challenges that have come with diving into a new market and culture. In those early days on these shores, she humbled herself when she met with studio executives or magazine editors. She explained who she was back in India. "By now, being dismissed can sting. I'll be mad, I'll be angry, I'll be annoyed," Priyanka says. "I'll speak about it to my family. I might cry a little bit, but it doesn't change my relationship with my work and what my actual quest is. My quest is not people's opinions. My quest is my job. My quest is making sure that when someone watches something that I have done, it moves them or they enjoy it. My personal life, who I am, all of that is not my job. Her personal life, of course, remains under a microscope nonetheless. On a random Monday in November, Priyanka changed her Instagram handle to just her first name, and the infernal machine known as the Internet decided that it meant trouble for her marriage. Then she responded to a video that Jonas had posted with lusty comment and cute emojis, and the world was soothed. All this happened during a 12-hour period on just one day of her life. It's a very vulnerable feeling, actually, that if I post a picture, everything that's behind me in that picture is going to be zoomed in on and people are going to speculate, Priyanka says. It's just a professional hazard. Because of the noise of social media, because of the prevalence that it has in our lives, I think it seems a lot larger than it is. I think that we give it a lot more credence in real life, and I don't think it needs that. One recent social media backlash flared up when The Activist, a new reality competition show that Priyanka may judge, was criticized for pitting activists against each other. I have no idea what they're going to do with it yet, she says now, adding that the producers have gone back to the drawing board to retool the show. I've been involved with Global Citizen for so many years, and I know the strides that they've made when it comes to global poverty and climate change. They've done incredible work. So it's really tragic when someone like that happens, because that is never the intention. Again, I can see the frustration work its way under her skin. It makes me sad, because I try to live my life as a good person every day, doing the best I can, just like everyone else. And it would just be nice to be seen for that sometimes. Jonas tells me he's never seen his wife get overwhelmed by the pressures of fame. We both know that public life is something that comes with what we do, he says. But we've set real boundaries around our personal lives, our privacy, and worked really hard to create that little safe haven for ourselves, with our friends and family. That safe haven includes a tight circle of loved ones. Even while I'm visiting their home, Jonas's family is upstairs, in town for the Diwali party. Priyanka jokes that her mother, who lived with her and Jonas after COVID-19 cases skyrocketed in India, pushed her to launch her production company when she was turning 30 by telling her, "Oh my God, you're not going to have an acting career anymore because everybody wants to work with a younger one, so we need a business." Her mother, she adds lovingly, has eased up recently. "Her attention is diverted by my marriage. She's very much an Asian mom, very excited about the fact that I finally did it." She laughs. She had no hope. Presumably, her mother also hopes for a grandchild. "They're a big part of our desire for the future," says Priyanka. By God's grace, when it happens, it happens. I point out that both their lives seem busier than ever. "No, we're not too busy to practice," she says. I laugh and clarify that I wasn't talking about sex, but rather about their breakneck pace with work. They will have to slow down when a child enters their lives. "I'm okay with that," she says. "We're both okay with that." The next time I speak to Priyanka, she's in an entirely different place, both physically and mentally. It's 3 weeks later, and she has returned to London to shoot the epic action series Citadel. She's working nights, and jokes that she's still on LA time despite the new location. She is alone instead of in a busy home filled with family and friends. Amazon aims to make Citadel a global action franchise, with Priyanka and Richard Madden starring in the Mothership series, followed by spin-offs in Italy, India, Spain, and Mexico. The show has demanded months of her time and energy. Among other things, she will get to speak 6 languages in it. Later this year, Priyanka will also have her first lead role in a Hollywood feature film, Text for You. I'm such a sucker for a good romantic comedy, like a date night movie that makes your heart go soft, Priyanka says. To understand the variety of projects on Priyanka's plate right now, you just have to remember the goal that gleams up ahead, to build a career as varied as the one she had in India. There, Priyanka played an Olympic boxer, an autistic teen, a femme fatale, a general's wife, and a model. In the 2009 comedy, What's Your Rashi, she played 12 different characters. People here haven't seen her in a diverse set of roles like they have in India, says Acharya, Priyanka's manager. I see her like Julia Roberts. We saw Julia Roberts in comedy, and then we saw her stripped down for Aaron Brockovich. For Pri, what's exciting is how people respond when they see who she really is. Priyanka echoes the sentiment. I think as an actor, it'll be a really crucial time for me, she says. I want to do movies that are not always bright and shiny. I want to be able to unravel as an artist on screen. I want to work under the tutelage of really brilliant minds. And I want to be pushed. I'm ready to be pushed. This year, Priyanka will also shoot an untitled comedy with Mindy Kaling that she and Kaling developed together. That one is a really big piece of my heart for many reasons, she says of the film, which was inspired by her wedding and the uniting of her Indian culture and Jonas's American one. I remember when Universal bought it in the room. We held hands under the table because I was like, I don't remember the last time I've seen a buddy comedy with two brown people. There are even more projects in the works. Priyanka is developing Sheila for Amazon, in which she'll play Ma Anand Sheila, the spiritual advisor made famous in the Wild Wild Country documentary for her part in the 1984 Rajneeshi bioterror attack in Oregon. And she will return to India to film her first Hindi project in a number of years, a road movie centered on three women, which will also star two other Bollywood actors, Katrina Kaif and Alia Bhatt. But I sense a push and pull in Priyanka that seems new to her. She's close to capturing the Hollywood career she's always dreamed of. But, like many women at the top of their field who have chosen to prioritize their mental health, she clearly doesn't want to spend all of 2022 grinding herself into the ground or being alone in an empty London apartment, working nights. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.